All right, turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11, at the end of the verse, you have this statement: time and chance happeneth to them all. Time and chance happeneth to them all. You might wonder what that means, and we're going to explore that in a moment. But perhaps in your own life, you have experienced what time and chance is. One of the things I've attempted to do in the different secular jobs that I've worked is to get to know the people that I work with. And I have worked with people with all kinds of different backgrounds. And one of the sad things that I've noticed at different jobs, as I've attempted when I was working my way through Bible college to work my way through college, is I've met people who have advanced degrees and yet were working some very, really menial jobs. I recall at one job I was working in a warehouse, and our job consisted of loading and unloading packages, of opening up boxes and of stocking shelves and unstocking shelves. And as I worked and during my shift, I worked side by side with a man who had a master's degree in journalism. And he obviously was a learned fellow and could probably write circles around me. But there we were, both together. Time and chance had happened to us both. I remember another job where I was working making dashboards for BMWs. And I think it was called the X5 at the time. It was an injection molding plant, and I was running a machine, and every day, dozens, hundreds of times, we laid a plastic skin inside of a mold, and then it was two halves, and the two halves would come down, and then it would inject a special foam into the mold, and then when the mold opened, you could pull out a dashboard to an X5. And I worked on that machine with him. And it was a horrible, smelly, sweaty work environment. And the man I was working with was from another country where he had been a doctor. And here he was with me in this horrible, really, I didn't like that job. And I didn't last very long because it was a temporary job. The Lord put me somewhere else. But he was still there when I left. Time and chance had happened to him. The statistics for how many people graduate from college and end up in jobs that they really don't want are rather staggering. I didn't look up the latest statistic to try to determine, you know, how many people graduate with baccalaureate degrees and master's degrees and PhDs who end up flipping hamburgers. But you look it up, it is rather depressing to see what's happening out there in the economy. And lost people. People who have no hope in Jesus Christ, all they can say is, well, I just ran out of my luck. It's just, you never know what's going to happen. You know, this is just the way it turned out for me. I'm hoping it's going to get better someday, but time and chance happened to me. If you look at the whole verse here, you'll see specifically the different types of people that Solomon says time and chance happens too. Look at verse 11. Solomon writes, I returned and saw under the sun. Now that phrase under the sun is a precursor to him introducing a worldview that is sort of divorced from the idea of God. It is as things appear to be apart from a worldview that includes the Lord, the God of Solomon. It is life under the sun. And he says here in verse 11 that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. Now, you meditate on each characteristic and you end up with quite a list of advantages. There are those who are very swift, whether that's swift of feet and they break global records and they run in the Olympics, or whether that's swift of mind They have photographic memories, or they have the ability to think rapidly and speak well on their feet. Those kinds of people are everywhere. Perhaps you've met one. Certainly when we watch the Olympics and we look at the different races that they have there, you see some pretty fast people. But Solomon points out that it's not always an advantage, because you could have someone and they are extremely fast and they lose because of time and chance. Chance is an amazing thing when it comes to fast-moving objects. Consider a motorcycle. I knew a man once who had a very nice motorcycle. I don't know if it was one of those really fast ones that you see tearing down the highway. But he was driving down past our church, and there was one little rock. Just a little one. And he hit it, and he spun his bike out of control, and he was in the hospital. Now, he had an object of great speed, but time and a rock took it away from him. And so it is in the sports industry that the best athletes can pull a muscle or break a bone or get a concussion. Something can happen to the very best football player out there, the best quarterback you know. Think of one. You know football better than I do. Think of one that you might know who had a promising career ahead of him. And it was that one injury, and that was it. He was done. Where is he today? Solomon says that the race is not always to the swift. The next statement here speaks of the strong. Surely we know strong people that are out there. Of course, one of the best examples of a strong man in your Bible is Samson. Here is a man chosen by God before his birth to be a Nazarite, to live a holy life. And he was endowed with incredible power, just like a superhero. He could go out and take the jawbone of an animal and slay his enemies with his bare brute strength. He was unstoppable on the battlefield. And yet his final sight was the jagged objects of knives coming in to pluck out his eyeballs. And the last thing he felt was that grimy, sort of smooth surface of the pillars in the temple of a false god. He died a failure. You might say, well, he slew more people in his death than in his life, and in that sense, he could be a success. But did the battle really go his way? But you say Samson, the womanizer, the one who gave in to the sins of his flesh over and over again and finally ended up dying in such a way. Would you say in his case that the battle went to the strong? Would you really say that? It's interesting here because he says next, bread to the wise. And he's going to sort of expand on this idea when we get down in verse 13. And we're going to look today at verses 11 to verse 18. He has more to say about wisdom, so I'll leave that for those verses when we get there. But then there is men of understanding. And they don't always get the money that you think they deserve. Now, we live in a day, and I think I have used illustrations of the richest men on the planet. And the top 10 richest individuals, whether they're a man, a woman, or a whole family, they measure their money in the billions today. I can't even comprehend that, really. What would you buy with $1 billion? But is it possible that they could lose it? I mean, is it possible that there's an individual who has really great understanding and yet he doesn't have the money that goes with it? Think of the stock market crash in the 20s. Think of the Great Depression. Think of all the suffering that went on, and yet still there were embedded in that historical context men that had incredible understanding, who knew how to make money, who knew how to turn a profit. How many of those men were the hobos that jumped on the local freight trains and didn't have enough money to go from one town to the next, and they slept on top of the boxcar because they hadn't figured out how to sneak inside of it yet. How many men of understanding do you think during the Great Depression rode those trains? Solomon says, sometimes time and chance, a stock market crash. And then there are those who have skill. He says here, nor yet favor to men of skill. Now, this could be a man who is a counselor. And you think of those who have the ability to counsel a president or a king or a world ruler. And they're very good at it. And yet, they face sort of a glass ceiling in their occupation. They never seem to be able to get past something, past this obstacle, maybe because they won't compromise their faith or because they just won't compromise their integrity. Or maybe they just, but really, what really he's talking about is verse 12. Here's sort of the molasses that people get stuck in. It says in verse 12, man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. So we can talk about the Great Depression, and would you call that an evil time? The word evil here has more the idea of a calamitous time than a morally reprobate time. So you have the swift, the strong, the wise, the understanding, and the skillful, and they get stuck. They get trapped in a time when none of those things are an advantage. Could it happen to us? Of course, that's probably the first thing that pops into our minds. I mean, could such a thing happen to us? Well, the answer, of course, is yes. There's nothing stopping this from happening to us except the grace of God and His love for us. But it could happen. Look at the illustrations a little more carefully in verse 12. There are fish, and they're just swimming along like they always do, eating whatever it is they always eat, and there's a net, and they're just scooped right up. And there are birds, and they're just doing whatever the birds do, and they don't know that there's a trap, a snare that's right there. And the parallel here, the illustrations, what they're primarily pointing out is that this evil time is a surprise. The fish did not anticipate the net, the bird, the snare, a man, an evil time. None of us know when it's going to happen. I mean, that's exactly what he says in verse 12. Look at the first part. Man also knoweth not his time. Like the fish didn't know it, or the bird. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And we could just tumble right into it. Now, that is what Solomon says, verse 11, when he returned and saw under the sun. And it's not very encouraging, is it? To those of us in this room that are Christians, our view of time and chance is far greater than this view. Next, in verse 13, he talks about wisdom. Again, if you look at verse 13, he uses the expression under the sun, which would indicate that, again, he is talking about sort of what he's observed apart from a Christian, what we would call a Christian worldview. In verse 13, he says, this wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. In other words, I saw it and it seemed to be appropriate to me, that it was right, that it was true. Verse 14, there was a little city, and few men within it. And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. All right, notice the repetition in our English translation. A great king, great bulwarks, great war machine here. The idea is it was an overwhelming force. It was unstoppable. It looked hopeless. verse 15. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. After talking about the evils of time and chance, he next adjusts our expectations when it comes to wisdom. Now, I need to say that these are all themes he's already covered in Ecclesiastes. But he thinks we're going to forget. Have you ever forgotten a sermon? Do you remember what I preached last Sunday? How about 3 Sundays ago? I gave myself a test the other day. I tried to remember what I preached. You think that would be easy? I can't believe how hard it is for a preacher to remember what he preached. If I'm having a hard time remembering what I preached, you're probably having a hard time remembering what I preached. By the way, that's why if you look at the end of your bulletin, you'll see sermon notes are back there that are from last week if you want to remind yourself of what I preached. And I also use this as a tool to remind myself by going through it what I preached. The Bible does include repetition for a reason. Because you and I tend to be awed by the rich and famous. If I throw out the name Albert Einstein, I mean, if the man, obviously he's gone and dead, he's dead and gone. But if you were to walk through those doors, if you lived during his days and you were to meet him, you would want to get your picture with that man. I would. That was an incredibly wise man, intelligent. You might think of someone else today that you personally are really respect. Someone who has been able to build, who's a CEO of a company and has been able to build a little empire, a business that is very successful, or maybe they're successful in the sporting industry and they've really mastered their game. Whatever it is, wisdom comes in all shapes and sizes and forms. There's the wisdom that it takes for NASA to build a space shuttle or a satellite. And by the way, God gives wisdom to all men. How? Generously. God gives wisdom to who? All men. Does God give wisdom to lost men and women? Absolutely. He's so generous, he even gives it to lost folks. How many Christians do you think built the rocket, the first one that ended up on the moon? Really, there's a lot of wisdom out there, and God is very generous with it. So we have a tendency to be awed by that and to think that is really what it's all about. If I was just wise enough to do this, I could be rich. I could have the perfect family. I could solve all my relational problems if I just had the wisdom that person had. And so Solomon in Ecclesiastes, he kind of rewinds and replays the idea that wisdom has limitations. Wisdom has limitations. And again, I say wisdom has limitations. And he has a right to say that, right? He was extremely wise. He was the wisest king ever in the life of Israel. And here's a man saying, you know what? My wisdom was not enough apart from God. And that's the point, because the beginning of wisdom is, Solomon did write in Proverbs 1, the fear of the Lord. But if you take out the fear of the Lord and you just talk about wisdom under the sun, it is severely limited. And that's what this next section is about. So what are the limitations here? Well, the first one that he points out here is poverty. Poverty limits wisdom. Look again at verse 15. There was found in it, that is in the city that's being attacked, a poor wise man. And he was able to deliver the entire city. Imagine that. The guy has nothing materially, but he's got the brain power to turn away an attack. And yet when he was done, verse 15, no man remembered that same poor man. Now you would think that someone would say, hip hip hooray, let's have a parade. Here he is. Let's call him Joshua. Joshua, the man of the day, the man of the hour. Mayor, let's get him a gift, a key to the city, something. You know, a little cash would work well from a few shekels for our friend Joshua. But how about a new house in the center of the city? He saved our city. But he was just this poor guy they all knew. Maybe he had one set of clothes, an old worn out pair of sandals, didn't make it to the river to bathe very often. Maybe even he was poor because his health wasn't that great, so he couldn't really work as hard as the younger men. And so, oh, thanks, Joshua. Good job. See ya. And that was it for the guy. His poverty, they couldn't look past his poverty. So poverty is something that limits wisdom. He says here that wisdom is better. Look at verse 16. Wisdom is better than strength. I mean, there are those times when if you got the brain power, you can best the bully. You can definitely do better than him. I mean, all he can do is swing a few punches at you, but you can outthink him, outmaneuver him, and outgun him. You can work circles around him. You're going to win. So wisdom is, you know, it's better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom, it's despised, and his words are not heard. Verse 17 and verse 18, he points out two other advantages to wisdom, but then he points out another disadvantage. He says in verse 17 that the words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. I mean, here's what you have. You've got, okay, this poor man, Joshua, is surrounded by the elders of the city, and he doesn't have to speak very loudly. He can wisely say the strategy that will overthrow the problem, and they're all ears. That's the contrast between someone who has to shout at the top of his lungs because he lives among fools, and they won't listen to a word he says, so he has to say, do what I'm telling you. You know, wisdom, wise words, sometimes don't have to be spoken very loudly. And so there is this idea in verse 17 that part of the value of wisdom, it comes from the people that you talk to. We know from the book of Proverbs that the rod is for the back of a fool. I mean, there are times when you may as well talk to a wall as talk to a fool. You waste your wisdom, Solomon says in Proverbs, on a fool. So the words of the wise, they can be heard in quiet. So there is an advantage to wise words that if the people are willing to listen. And verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war. I mean, there are times when you can rely so completely on wisdom that when you are outmatched and outgunned, you can win the day. You think, of course, of Old Testament stories and the things that God has done in this way. And one incident that comes to my mind is Jericho. Now, that is sort of out of the context because Joshua and the people there were obeying the Lord. He was very involved in the conquest of Jericho. And that was wise. So it's not really an under the sun godless paradigm, but nevertheless, it's definitely a time when they were facing huge insurmountable walls, and the wisdom of obeying the Lord gave them the victory. But verse 18, the second thing that really limits wisdom is one sinner. Look at it again at the end of verse 18. One sinner destroyeth much good? How is that possible? Well, you probably have experienced it. Have you ever heard the saying that a bad apple spoils the bushel? And have you ever worked anywhere that would have been heaven on earth except for that one person that messed it up every day. Have you ever worked in an environment like that? And sometimes you catch yourself thinking, boy, I would love this job if that person would just jump off a cliff. I would love it. And it only takes how many? One. Now, that is definitely a biblical principle, because when you get to the New Testament, Paul uses the same idea when he says a little leaven leavens the whole lump. If you're making bread, all it takes is a little bit of yeast and that bread rises. And in the context, Paul is talking about false doctrine and false teachers. All it takes to ruin Faith Bible Church is one false teacher. That's it. One sinner can destroy much good in our church. One person to come in here and to start teaching that Jesus is not God, or that the Bible is not reliable, inspired, and inerrant, or just one. And that is really surprising, isn't it? But that is the power of sin. How many sinners did it take to destroy the world? Two, right? Adam and Eve. Really, Adam. In Adam, all men fell. So that is the truth. So, to summarize this, it's not a very encouraging picture under the sun. For people out there who aren't Christians, they face time and chance. They may go to school and get a PhD in astrophysics, but they might end up working side by side with the guy at McDonald's making fries. And you might be really wise, but if you don't have a lot of money, it might not be worth a cent to you. And if you are around one sinner, just one, he could ruin all your plans. Much good could be destroyed. That brings me then to this, folks. We can't stop here as Christians. We have to at least recover what the Christian view of time and chance is. Now, I'm going to beg you to just stay with me, and I'm going to take you through a very short journey that hopefully will be an encouragement to you. And you might do well to write some of this down. What is the Christian view of time and chance? As we back away from Solomon's idea of life under the sun, apart from the Lord, apart from Yahweh and the coming Messiah, and we embrace Christianity and we open the Bible and we look at what it has to teach us, what does it teach us? Why time and chance? Why poverty? Why all of these things that we struggle with? Well, turn back to Genesis 3 quickly. Genesis 3. We struggle with time and chance first because we live in a sin-cursed earth. When you look at Genesis 3 and you see what happened when God had to talk to Adam and Eve about sin, look at Genesis 3, verse 11. God is confronting Adam and Eve after they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They run away and hide. God confronts them, and he says in verse 11, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." And the Lord said unto the woman, "What is this that thou hast done?" And the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat." And the Lord God said unto the serpent, "Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast." Now, I only want you to notice in verse 14 the word cursed. Would you like your friend to come up to you and curse you? No, it is not a good thing. So the snake is cursed to crawl on its belly and to have a certain diet, if you could put it that way. Verse 15, the snake is cursed because the relationship between it and whatever it looked at at the time and its progeny is going to be at enmity with the woman, verse 15. There's going to be a seed. There's going to be someone who's born of the woman who bruises the serpent's head. but you are going to bruise his heel. And of course, we see that as a prophecy of Jesus. Verse 16, unto the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam, he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it thou wast made. Now quickly, the earth, a Christian view of time and chance, always includes the fact that we live in a sin-cursed earth. Verse 17 says that there's going to be, verse 18, thorns and thistles are now coming out of the earth. Verse 19, something has so changed that Adam is going to have to work to the point of exhaustion, to the point of perspiration, and he is going to return to that earth. Something has happened in creation. There's this snake, and before there was some kind of communication or relationship with the snake. And of course, there was this perfect relationship with the animal kingdom. Theologically, before sin, Adam and Eve lived in peace with all the animal kingdom. Adam was able to name the animals. After sin, there is this curse leveled at the snake, and the whole environment is so changed that thorn and thistles now grow. And of course, we know that they were kicked out of paradise. Hundreds, thousands of years later, the result of this today is that creation is groaning, Paul writes in Romans. And we see this groaning in the form of typhoons, tornadoes, earthquakes. Could I put it this way? The very nature of the grinding of the plate tectonics of this planet is the result of sin. Would you say that that is theologically correct? I would. We live in a dangerous world. When I used to drive up to see my grandmother in McClure, Pennsylvania, I used to ask my parents, what are all these signs? Danger, falling rocks. Dad, I would ask my dad, you mean a rock could fall right off of that cliff and land on our car? And he said, yeah, it could. This is the world we live in. It is a sin-cursed earth. The environment, the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, it's all at odds with us. If you plant your garden this summer and you don't weed it, what will you have at the end of the season? Nothing. What about the bugs? What about the worms? What about the things, those really annoying little white worms that get in your corn? You ever had those on your corn? And they get in there and they just munch away. And the grossest thing is to shuck a piece of corn and you open it and there's that, blah, that slimy worm up there and half your corn's gone. But did you also notice, not only is the earth cursed, but their bodies have been cursed. Adam now works to the point of exhaustion and perspiration. He didn't have to do that evidently before. He has to face a world that's against him. And so, verse 19, there's the sweat, and until you return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. And that is the curse of death. So we live in a cursed environment and we have cursed bodies. Folks, this is scripture. Sin-cursed bodies are the reason why your back is killing you as you're sitting there. It's the reason why you have arthritis. It's the reason why some of you have had cancer or some major physical problem. It's the reason why when we get older, we get weaker and our health dissipates. It's because of sin. Every funeral you go to, when you look at that dead person lying in that coffin, you should remind yourself that is the result of sin. A sin-cursed earth, sin-cursed health. But maybe you didn't notice this. There is also, thirdly, the sin-cursed heart. Because now, when he talks to the woman, He says in verse 16, of course, verse 16 is also evidence of the health issue because she's going to have sorrow in her conception. So the scriptural idea here is, ladies, when you give birth and you are in pain, that also is a part of the result of sin. But it says at the end of verse 16 that the desire of the woman shall be for her husband and he will rule over her. Something has broken in the marital relationship that will never fully recover apart from Christ. There is this ruling of the husband over the woman that wasn't there before. Now, that is not to say that the one did not have authority over the other, but there is some sort of poisoning of that authority. Some sort of sickening of it, if you could put it that way. And it's a result of sin in the human heart. Do you remember last week from Ecclesiastes 9 how Solomon said that in the human heart is great evil? It's full of evil, and he used the word madness. So, a Christian worldview of time and chance is that all the earthquakes, all the typhoons, all the upheaval, the very plate tectonics of our earth, it is not due to chance. It is not due to some inexplicable time element. It's because of sin. The health problems we struggle with, the fact that some in this room are very sick, perhaps, is not an accident. It's because we live in a sinful world and our bodies are cursed because of sin. And your relational problems, marital problems, extended family problems, by the way, wars. You know how much famine in Africa is caused by genocide and the conflicts between tribes and overlords? And what is it with the drug trafficking in the Middle East, and how much conflict does that create politically? It's all because of the heart of sin that we all have. Not time and chance. Turn to John quickly. John 15. The Christian worldview of time and chance, frankly, is that there is no time and chance or anything called luck. We are realistic with the world that we live in, but we know this. We know that God loves the world. I don't know why. The Bible will do, yeah, would you love it? It's a mess. The scriptures never really tell us except that they say that God is love. And so we know from John 3:16, God so loved the world. It's not just love. In the Greek there, it's the idea of loving the world in this way. Or it could be an expression of force, like with so much, with such a greatness that he would give his only begotten son. Now, it's not like, you know, you get a Christmas present from your great aunt and it's a box of toothpicks. Oh, she really loves me. I love you, honey. Here you go. Clean your teeth. No, it's, wow, I got a brand new car from my aunt. She loved me that much. That's the idea in John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. The world that is cursed in its environment, the world that is cursed in, yes, but it's talking about people, us, sinners. And in John 15, we have some amazing statements about the world and our relationship to it. John 15, verse 16, the upper room discourse. Listen to what Jesus says to his followers. He says, "Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that ye should go and bring forth fruit." God loved the world. He sent Jesus down into this mess, and Jesus chose his apostles, and he chose them and ordained them to bring forth fruit. Look at the verse again, that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. These things I command you, that you love one another. If the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If ye were of the world, wait a minute. something's changed. Genesis 3 is the foundation of the sin-cursed world. We see it all through the Bible. But now Jesus is saying that these men are no longer of the world? How can that be? But he says it right here. Verse 19, if ye were of the world would love his own. But because ye are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me. So, what we learn from this passage, among other things, is that there are these people now that Jesus has somehow taken out of the world, and they are no longer of the world. Folks, that's you and me. Now, the passage tells us that we face another challenge. Everybody faces a sin-cursed world, but as Christians, we also face the added challenge of persecution. That's what he's saying here. But what he tells his apostles they're going to do, verse 16, please try to keep following me, is that it is in terms of being fruit bearers. It says in the middle of verse 16 that he's ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit and that your fruit should remain. So now we have these people that are not of the world. They're living in the world and they're going to be persecuted, but they're supposed to bear fruit. Now, what is this fruit? What's this fruit thing about? Well, I could take you to Matthew 28 and say that it's the Great Commission. But really, in terms of using the word fruit and fruitfulness in the New Testament, that would be a corollary idea, but it wouldn't be the main idea. Because he's going to go on and talk about the Spirit. And we have in Galatians 5, turn there quickly, try to keep hanging in there, we'll wrap this up. Galatians 5. This idea of the fruit of the Spirit. Galatians 5:22, and you know it well, I hope. If you don't, you can learn something new. The fruit of the Spirit. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. What's happening here? Well, we know from 1 John that we're living in this sinful world that's composed of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. But Jesus came down, and because he died on the cross, we can now trust him and become Christians, and we're now taken out of the world, and now we're supposed to demonstrate this fruit, and part of this fruit is this kind of character that's so different from the world. The world is grasping. The world makes everything about me. It's selfish and egocentric. Christians, they're supposed to have the fruit of the Spirit. And so there's this clash, there's this war that's going on. So folks, time and chance. How does all this relate to time and chance? Well, the struggle between those that are not in the world, or that are in the world but not of the world, and the world, it's all been predicted. Jesus ordained it. The Father ordained it that you and I as Christians should bear fruit. That fruit bearing creates persecution. We already exist in a world that is cursed by sin. And somebody says, thanks a lot, Pastor. I can go home and be encouraged. How is this supposed to encourage me? What about my tax bill, my family problems? How's all this stuff going to work out? And of course, that's the exact point of Romans 8. Turn there, final passage. That's the precise context of Romans 8. Romans 8, verse 18. Let the word of God speak to you as we read this. I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected it the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For the man seeth, why doth he yet hope for it? But if we hope for that which we see not, then do we with patience wait for it. Likewise, the Spirit also helps our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought. But the Spirit himself maketh intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. And he that searcheth the hearts knoweth what is the mind of the Spirit, because he maketh intercession for the saints according to the will of God. Now hang in there, I'm only going to read the verse 30. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. What's his purpose, Paul? Verse 29. This is the purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called, and whom he called, them he also justified, and whom he justified, them he also glorified. Folks, did you see the context? He moves from the groanings of creation to the groanings of the Spirit on our behalf. He wedges in between there our own personal anguish and groanings as we live not in time and chance, but in a sin-cursed world. And he ties it all together and he says, look, every last detail of your life, from the smallest pain to the greatest circumstance that perplexes you, it is all of it working together for your good. And the good and the purpose is that you would be conformed to the image of Christ. And that goes right back to John 15, because we're ordained to bear fruit. And the fruit of the Spirit is the character of Christ. See, when it comes to your struggles this week, there is no accident. My friend, you and I got to get to the place in our lives when you actually believe that when you face a trial, it is so that you will become more like Christ, and that that trial was ordained before the foundation of the world. That it is so much controlled by God and to be used to your good, that it is actually from the very hand of love. Are you convinced today that when you struggle with your spouse, that God can use that to your good? Or does the character of Christ even matter to you? Outside, under the sun, it's time and chance, and the race doesn't go to the swift, and the wise people don't always get the money, and you know, your poor wisdom might not work for you. But inside the household of God, we walk by faith, and faith says that even though we live in a sin-cursed world and we face persecution, that ultimately every detail will work out for our good. Do you believe that this morning?